the heart of flyover country, this is Spin Sold Separately.
Well, the Canadians got the best of us in the end. Oh, the Habs wouldn't go down without a fight, and in the end, they got the better of us in the final of that NHL Four Nations Cup. Way to go, Canada. One last laugh before we annex you. Oh, come on, have a sense of humor about it. If you're too sensitive to know when you're being trolled in 2025, I don't think you have much of a future anyway. And there is no one better at trolling than the current president of the United States. Oh, welcome back to Spin Sold Separately, everyone. I am JD. Thank you so much for joining me once again. Yeah, boy, I gotta admit, I didn't really think much of that Four Nations Cup when I heard about it. It's like, yeah, you know, we already have the Olympics, and a few years ago they did the World Cup of Hockey, and you know, it felt like we already had a fair amount of international competition among the elite hockey players in the world. But man, that Four Nations Cup took on an absolute mind of its own there. Did you get a chance to watch that final game? I certainly did. I watched it from start to finish. And even though the end result was not what we Americans were cheering for, and again, congrats to Canada, all jokes aside, they played an outstanding game. The whole game was entertaining as hell. Very, very intense. And, you know, it was tight. It was never more than one goal. You know, either way, the Canadians scored first, and the U.S. tied it, and then the U.S. took the lead, and then the Canadians tied it, and then, of course, it's number 97, Connor McDavid, in overtime. I never played a minute of hockey in my life, so far be it from me to criticize the best players in the world, but how on earth does Connor McDavid, the best hockey player on the planet, how does he get loose 10 feet in front of the net with nobody around him, with time to, like, pick his spot? And I remember, you know, the U.S. had so many chances right before that. Three or four just amazing looks at the other end where Austin Matthews could have ended it, and it flutters up, you know, it catches Jordan Binnington, the goalie for Canada. Matthews is loose in the slot, and he gets the shot off, and it just catches the upper part of Binnington's blocker enough to flutter the puck over the crossbar or just off to the side. I mean, it didn't miss the net by, it didn't look like 6 inches. And then, like, 10 seconds later, Brady Tkachuk's got 3/4 of the net to shoot at, and he rips one, gets it all. Binnington just throws his glove up and snares it out of midair. I mean, nothing fluky about it. But Binnington, who's not having a good year in the NHL for his regular team, the St. Louis Blues, they've probably been wondering, where the hell has this been all season long? Nothing fluky about it. He stood tall when he had to, withstood the fury. I mean, again, the U.S. had 3 or 4, I mean, grade A chances to end that game early in overtime and just couldn't get it past him. And then really the first really good look Canada got, I mean, I remember watching that play. And as soon as the puck came out, you know, one of the Canadian, I wish I could remember who it was, one of the Canadian forwards, he's in the corner. And he gets it out towards McDavid in the middle, who's all by himself. And I mean, Austin Matthews was out there trying to get in the passing lane, but he missed it, and the puck got through. And as I saw it land on McDavid's stick, I'm like, oh crap. And before I got the crap out, it was already in the upper corner of the net. Game over. Canada wins. And again, congratulations to Canada, all jokes aside. Hockey is their sport. They have many of the best players in the world, and they are the deserved winners of that Four Nations face-off. And it was really entertaining. I'm not sure what kind of future it has. I mean, a lot of really big-name players were involved in this, and the intensity was dialed up so much. A lot of players, specifically on the Canada and U.S. teams in that final game, there's a lot of players on both those teams that are going to miss some significant time because of injuries sustained in that little tournament. And, you know, now their NHL teams don't have them. And the NHL's kind of in the stretch run here. There's about 25, you know, 28-ish games left in the regular season before they get to their playoffs. And it'll be interesting to see how GMs, coaches, team owners across the league decide, you know, how to handle this going forward. Like, is it, don't get me wrong, I love seeing players passionately playing for their country and leaving absolutely everything out there and caring to the degree that they did. So don't get me wrong here, but looking at it from an NHL team front office ownership perspective, is this what you want your best players doing two-thirds of the way through the season when you're going to need them the most down the stretch and into the playoffs? And the way the intensity was dialed up to such a high level in this tournament, and I see no reason why that wouldn't exist in any future tournaments, it's going to be difficult for these owners, these GMs, and these coaches to sign off on this. I mean, from a fan's perspective, I mean, I want this every single year, but I can also look at it from their side and say, yeah, it's not this is not without unintended cost, and that unintended cost is hitting a few NHL teams pretty hard right now, and we'll see how much it really affects them down the stretch here. But overall, the product was amazing. The interest level was, I mean, it was on par with the Stanley Cup Finals as far as viewership. I really hope it continues, but I'm not going to hold my breath. So one last congratulations to Canada. Now I'm back to cheering for my Minnesota Wild. They won their first game back in overtime. Brock Faber, who played on the USA team on, you know, Thursday night in an overtime game, I think he skated 28 minutes. The Wild played on Saturday at like 11:30 a.m. and Faber skated another 30 minutes. The kid's a machine, but I really hope we don't just grind him into the ground here, because skating anybody 30 minutes a game is probably not going to last long. But he's an amazing young player. I'm so glad as a Wild fan that we've got him locked up for the long term. He played for the Gophers, the Minnesota Gophers, in college, so everybody around here already knew who he was, and then we get him in that trade with LA, and he has been everything any of us ever could have hoped for, and then some. He is already a top-flight defenseman in the NHL, and I think the sky's the limit for him. He's going to be one of the best defensemen in the NHL for many years to come, and we here in Minnesota are lucky to have him. Sadly, for the second episode in a row, I have to give you a
clean up on aisle 5, please. Clean up on aisle 5.
I said in the last show that the new Syrian leader was a terrorist. That part is accurate. But that he was a former member of Al-Qaeda and Hamas. And that was not completely accurate. He is a former member of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So again, I don't want to get any details wrong here. If anybody, you know, if that subject ever comes up in your friend group, I don't want you to say, oh yeah, he was a member of Al-Qaeda and Hamas, and have somebody say, well, you're an idiot, and then you say, well, I heard it on a podcast, JD said it was Al-Qaeda and Hamas. No, it was actually Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and now he has broken off into his own, in his own direction. Yeah, his name is Ahmed al-Shara. He is not a self-identified terrorist, but again, he has that background, so as if the Middle East needed more instability, there is your new leader of Syria, so we will see what happens there. Also, I was so busy admonishing the federal judge that blocked the pause on the federal payments, that issued that national injunction on the pause in federal money handouts, that I forgot to give you the judge's name. And far be it from me to deny people like this the fame and notoriety they so richly deserve. His name is John McConnell, again, federal judge in Rhode Island. That is the man that stopped the president's executive order on the federal payment pause that has led to all the consternation in the world from the Democrats, from people that have taken the bizarre position of defending the federal bureaucracy. Again, I wish you all the best of luck. We've all been admonishing the federal government and how bloated it is and how overfunded it is for my entire adult lifetime. But because Trump's doing it, remember, it has to be bad. So I really wish you all the best on defending the indefensible. So anyway, there is this show's version of
clean up on aisle 5, please. Clean up on aisle 5.
And as always, we are here to clean up any mess that I make on a show-to-show basis. I've talked about discussing education for a while now, and I'm not going to discuss it in the way that I thought I was going to. I will still do that at some point in the future here. The real hard statistics on the overall erosion of our education system, the test results that our kids are generating. We will get into all the hard numbers about how we are not testing as well on a variety of subjects as other developed industrialized nations are. We will get into the nitty gritty on those statistics maybe in a future show. But I want to clarify what I said in the last show when I said, you know, homeschool your kids. There is so much bad stuff going on behind the scenes. That was not a shot at teachers or local educators. Now, there are some bad actors out there, as there are in every profession. And there is video evidence everywhere. A lot of it self-promoted on TikTok of the open indoctrination that a few of our teachers are taking part in when we send our kids to school to learn math and reading and science, and instead they're getting a full-on left-wing indoctrination camp. Now, that is not happening in every classroom, obviously, and that is not what I meant. There are most people in the education system, I believe, are there for all the right reasons. And of course, the Department of Education is in the spotlight right now because, yes, Republicans have long wanted to get rid of the Department of Education. It is the sixth largest expense on the federal budget that, again, I have to remind people to get into arguments with me about this stuff, is $2 trillion over budget. That is not a fact you can ignore, people. It's not sustainable. We have about 5 or 6 years. If we don't change a thing, we have about 5 or 6 years until we are in the exact same position as Japan and Venezuela. We have to act. And the reason the Department of Education is getting so much scrutiny right now is, A, it is a very large contributor to our federal budget. Again, sixth largest behind Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, national defense, and the interest on the debt. Education is the next line item. That and I'm going to need a real explanation on what some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. has to do with my kids' education here in the cornfields. If I have a problem with my kids' education here in the cornfields, I'm not going to Washington, D.C. I'm going to my local school district, or I'm going to my dumbass state of Minnesota. And that's where a lot of the people on this side of the argument are coming from. These people in D.C. are so far removed from the actual education of our kids. I don't know. Our education system seemed to function just fine until 1979 when this department was created. And again, we'll get into these numbers another day, but it has been a steady decline in student performance ever since, no matter how much money we throw at it. Why is that? Now, maybe you can't put your finger on exactly why that is. I can tell you it shouldn't be that way. Ostensibly, if we're sitting at number one in 1979, and you create this federal Department of Education and then throw a bunch of federal money at education, you'd think we would just increase our lead on the rest of the world in education. Well, that, to say the least, has not been what's happened ever since. Nobody can seem to put a finger on why. So that's why this particular department has become the topic of discussion it has. No, it's not because the people that voted for Donald Trump hate our kids and don't want them to be educated. Seriously. Is the left in this country, and I say this as somebody who historically has not been partisan, I am not of the right. You people on the left continue to push me further and further into your opponent's camp because of how you behave. Why can't we have a reasonable discussion about that? Why is it immediately, oh, you just hate kids and you want them to, you know, you don't want to educate the kids? God, what the hell sense does that make? And where does that lead any kind of what could have been a meaningful conversation about it? Anyway, schools are still going to get money, okay? They're still going to get federal money. What a lot of us on this particular side of this argument are talking about is, what do we need that big bureaucracy for? It obviously isn't doing the kids any good. The test results themselves dictate as much. You can't argue with the results. You can play every bit of emotional blackmail on me you want. You are not going to convince me that the Department of Education in this country has been a net positive for students, because the results universally dictate otherwise. Now, the federal money, the money that the Department of Education gets, obviously it goes several different directions. It also goes to all 50 states. So what my side of this argument is talking about is getting rid of the federal bureaucracy of education and just sending the money that the states already get through the Department of Education, or at least a vast majority of it, sending it directly to the states and letting the states handle their education system, as they largely already do. That way, when you have an issue with your local education system, you're a lot closer to the people involved in it. You don't have to worry about going to D.C. to fight some federal battle against some unnamed, faceless bureaucrat. Congress is still going to allocate money for education. It's not like we're just going to turn the spigot off on this $268 billion. Just cross it out and move on to number 7. Okay? We're talking about cutting out the middleman. The federal bureaucracy that has little, if anything, to do with actually educating our children. Which I strongly believe would improve accountability on the local level. You know, the people that answer to the parents in the communities will be at the state and local level, not lost in Washington. No one wants or should have to go deal with Washington, D.C. to deal with issues affecting the education of their kids. This should be handled at the state and local level as it always was before the Department of Education was ever created. There will still be funding, even from the federal level. It's just going to skip the administrative state along the way and go directly to states and local school districts. Seriously, give me the downside of that argument. Education handled on a more local, more accountable level, just getting its money directly from Congress instead of from the DOE. What's wrong with that? Seriously. Now, not surprisingly, because the Democrats are obviously on the other side of this because, you know, again, Trump's doing it, so it's bad. There is a nauseating superiority complex developing amongst academia. I mean, even more than we're already used to. They've already had this stench about them that they have this air of superiority that is just stomach-turning. But, I mean, it has hit a fever pitch with this discussion. You know, they love to throw around a bunch of big words and program-specific jargon. And then dismiss the rest of us as the great unwashed that, you know, without them, we'd be living like cavemen in the limestone of Kentucky, living off tree bark and slug slime. They're so busy hyper-analyzing tiny little anecdotal, again, emotional blackmail threads of an issue that they completely lose the big picture that, if ignored, renders their anecdotal threads and their piercing vocabulary completely irrelevant. And again, I'm seeing this in my own world, you know, from people that I love and care about. You know what? Go ahead. Go on and on about how smart you are and about how the rest of us plebes that voted for this administration, and by the way, are getting exactly what we voted for. Stop coming to us with, hey, Trumpsters, this is what you voted for. You're getting what you deserved. We're all like, uh-huh. And? That's not the flex you think it is, folks. This is exactly what a lot of us voted for. But yes, just keep going on about how overly intelligent you are and how the rest of us schmucks, that we'd all be amoebic one-celled organisms without your precious academia to save us from ourselves. You know, meanwhile, those of us who dare to take a slightly more nuanced approach at this issue are noticing a few things. I notice that the industry you're defending is $36 trillion in debt and getting worse. I notice how we throw over a quarter of $1 trillion at the Department of Education every single year and are regressing in every measurable statistic that can't simply be manipulated by lowering standards. I notice our children are not as proficient at, say, reading, writing, or arithmetic as they were 45 years ago when the Department of Education was created. I notice that our schools aren't any newer or better. Or safer. I notice we still don't have enough teachers. And the ones that we do have are starting GoFundMe pages so they can buy their own school supplies for their classrooms. Are you freaking kidding me, by the way, with that? We spend over $250 billion a year on education and we still have to buy our own spray cleaners for classrooms so our kids can bring them on the first day of school every year so our teachers have cleaning supplies. I keep hearing that the technology is so outdated. What? Where does all this money go? If it's not going to teachers, buildings, supplies, or technology, where the hell is it going? My local school district, the minute the COVID funding was shut off, immediately came to the voters in the form of a referendum and begged for money to upgrade technology, preying once again on the emotions of parents, saying how much they'd have to cut if the voters didn't agree to send them more money. What were you doing with this endless faucet of money that was being dumped on you for the better part of 3 years? And the minute that gets shut off, they're back begging for more money from the voters, who, oh, by the way, are struggling with their own issues, if you haven't noticed. No, just accuse us of hating children, because, yeah, we're the side that hates kids. I notice childhood diabetes, anxiety, depression, and obesity are all exponentially worse than they were 45 years ago. I notice that we feed kids frozen pizza and french fries at school, while kids in other industrialized nations are eating salads and fresh cooked meals. I notice that we're graduating kids from our school systems that clearly are not ready for adulthood. I give you Exhibit A, our college campuses. I notice we keep lending money to college students that graduate with degrees so valuable to society that they move on to the real world and won't ever make enough money in their chosen field of study to so much as pay their student loans back, forcing electricians and tractor-trailer drivers all across the country to absorb this cost for them. And I also noticed that these colleges don't really seem to have a problem with this arrangement, because while they're gladly accepting six figures from every student that walks through their doors, allowing them to major in gender studies or art history, and graduating them onto an almost certain life of struggle and below-average income, they sit on 10 and 11-figure endowments. You know what, academics out there? These are all the things that us plebs are noticing. You don't have to have a master's or a PhD to have an opinion on this stuff. Ask yourself what you're defending. What are you defending? Do you really think that everyone that supports this administration is actively working against children? Against education? We want to deprive our children of necessary educational resources? Give me a break. Bring me an adult argument, please. No, we're advocating for a different approach, a new strategy of reallocating the resources that have so clearly been misused and mismanaged, at the very least, for decades. How else do you explain the ever-eroding results despite ever-increasing funding? That's a serious question. No private sector business could ever survive this way. Why is government looked on any differently? No, we're not looking for government operations or the DOE to generate a profit. That's obviously a fundamental difference between the private sector and the public sector. But we do require that these public sector institutions give us some kind of return on our investment. Something that can be measured in other ways. Through academic achievement that's measurable by actual knowledge and expertise, not just by lowering standards. Institutions that operate within a budget and produce the desired results, not ones that operate on annual deficits and fail in their most fundamental reasons for existing. You've taken the side of defending the bureaucrats. Think about that for a minute. I don't see that going well for you. The other big topic I want to talk about today is the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. You'll be shocked to learn that there is a lot more to this here than meets the eye, or that's being reported on a day-to-day basis by the legacy media. I know, you're shocked to hear that. You've been hearing a lot about this recently, mainly because of Trump's comments on this that came out last week. Now, Trump campaigned on ending this war quickly if he was elected, and 1 month in, yeah, it's not over, but we are far closer to this war coming to some kind of an acceptable ending than at any time during the Biden administration. So I figured that now would be a good time to kind of run through a quick history of that area. No, this is not going to be like a Ukrainian civics class, but I want to at least give you the major points of the last, say, 30-ish years that have kind of led to where we are right now. What led to this conflict in the first place? And then talk about what the most likely outcome is and what could hopefully keep this from happening again. Now, most of this summation comes from the U.S. News and World Report. December 1991. Now, don't worry. This is going to go faster than you think, given that date. Now, December 1991. Following the dissolution of the former Soviet Union, Ukraine, which was one of the former republics of the Soviet Union, voted overwhelmingly for independence. And immediately upon that vote, becoming the second largest country in Europe by size. Now, many that lived in Ukraine at the time were, you know, not surprisingly Russian by descent. So keep that in mind as we go through this here. December 1994, what was known as the Budapest Memorandum was signed. In agreement with Ukraine, this agreement was signed by the United States, the United Kingdom, and Russia. Following an agreement with Ukraine to transfer all of its Cold War-era nuclear weapons to Russia, becoming a non-nuclear power country. Now, before this agreement was in place, Ukraine, surprisingly, held the third largest nuclear stockpile on Earth. So, as part of this agreement, all of the signatories, Russia included, agreed to honor the sovereignty of Ukraine and respect its right to its territory. Now, fast forward to 2004. Ukraine held a very contentious presidential election. The Western-supported candidate, who went by the name of Viktor Yushchenko, opposed the more Russia-backed candidate, Viktor Yanukovych, and I apologize if I am mispronouncing any of these names. Long story short, Yushchenko, who again was supported by the more Western supporters of Ukraine, Yushchenko was poisoned before the election, but he did recover. Yanukovych declared victory. The Russian-backed candidate, Viktor Yanukovych, declared victory, and Ukrainians took to the streets to protest what they thought was an unfair election, and it did force a new election, which ultimately the Western-supported candidate Yushchenko won. So you can already see things are not going well in Ukraine. Now, fast forward to April 2008. During a NATO summit, a debate over whether or not to create a path for Ukraine to become a member of the, at the time, 28, now 32-nation alliance was discussed. There are several things that have to happen for a country to join NATO, and the reason it is so difficult to join NATO specifically has to do with what you've probably heard referred to as Article 5 protection, which is a part of the NATO contract and agreement, treaty, whatever you want to call it, between these nations, that an attack on one is an attack on all. So if any member nation is attacked by another country, it is just the same as that aggressing country attacking all, again, now 32 nations in the NATO alliance. And it triggers certain things among all of these countries and their military agreements with one another. Say what you want about NATO, it is not a force to be reckoned with, having that many nations, including obviously the United States, behind it. Now, by this time, Vladimir Putin had ascended to power in Russia. And by this time, he had made his opposition to this idea very, very clear. Putin didn't want any more NATO countries on its border. Now, I'm going to say a lot of things about Russia's point of view here, Putin's point of view here. You don't have to agree with it. We all know that Russia is not a model country. We all know that Vladimir Putin is a vicious dictator. We all know the world would be a better place if Russia was run more like Western democracies, okay? You don't have to be a Putin puppet to at least discuss the other side's point of view of this conflict and of the geopolitical realities that they face, okay? We all know they're in the wrong. This is not this is not a pro-Putin take on this. This is a nuanced discussion on this because we need to understand where both sides are coming from. We don't need to agree with both sides, but we have to understand them. So, we all know that Russia would be a better place if they were more like us. Right? At least in most ways. We all know that Russia would be a better place if it was run more like a Western democracy, okay? It isn't. This is the reality. And more on this in a minute. Now, Putin at this summit allegedly went so far as to declare to President Bush that Ukraine, quote, isn't even a real nation state. Foreshadowing of the events to come, no doubt. Now, so ultimately, at this particular summit, NATO does not offer a path to membership for Ukraine. So the whole thing kind of went quiet for a while. Fast forward to November of 2013, more political controversy in Ukraine. Now, remember the Russian-backed candidate, Yanukovych, who lost that election in 2004, had run again and won in 2010, aligning himself more with the West and the European Union than he had in the past. Now, not surprisingly, he ultimately continued the path that he'd followed his entire political life to that point and continued to steer Ukraine more towards Russia upon getting elected. Now, combine this with the very controversial arrest of his political opponent, sound familiar? Yulia Tymoshenko. This led to protests in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. Now, it got ugly. Dozens of civilians were killed in this unrest. And this ultimately led to Yanukovych fleeing to Russia, leaving Ukraine utterly leaderless. Now, what do dictators normally do when they sense weakness? They act. And almost immediately, Putin and Russia seized this opportunity presented by the unrest in Ukraine and a world stage featuring a weaker America under President Obama on the world stage to invade Crimea, which is a Ukrainian peninsula kind of in the north end of the Black Sea and an area with a largely Russia-friendly population. Now, this move, of course, sparks outrage among the entire international community. It's condemned by the United Nations. It's condemned by the European Union. Now, this went on for a very long time, and Russia never relinquished this territory. And over the ensuing years, the provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk, again, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing these correctly, Donetsk and Luhansk, known collectively as Donbas, in eastern Ukraine, would also break away under disputed circumstances. These are also areas that are populated largely by those of Russian ethnicity. So the unrest is spreading. Russia has now invaded Crimea, and these two provinces, Donetsk and Luhansk, have kind of broken away via, you know, depending on what you read, via separatists, if you will, in eastern Ukraine that were more sympathetic to Russia. So now, April 2019, Volodymyr Zelensky is elected overwhelmingly in Ukraine, along with his party winning a majority of seats in the Ukrainian parliament, on the promises to end the war with Russia and free the Ukrainian government of corruption, which was rampant. So, Zelensky gets elected in 2019, move forward to December of 2021. Now, Zelensky had been making good on his promise in his attempt to remove some troublesome oligarchs from his government, some of whom were very buddy-buddy and very friendly to the Russian cause, such as one particular oligarch by the name of Viktor Medvedchuk, who was a very, very close friend of one Vladimir Putin. So as a result of this, Putin begins increasing his military presence along the Ukrainian border and demands security guarantees from both NATO and specifically from the United States that Ukraine will never be admitted to NATO. Now remember, at that summit he said, you know, I demand that Ukraine will not be admitted. Well, now, after seeing this more quote-unquote democratic ruler, Zelensky, in Ukraine, he senses that these Western democracies are kind of closing in on him. As NATO continued to expand its influence and add countries, now Putin is seeing democracy, at least of some form, growing in Ukraine. So he demands from the United States and from NATO that Ukraine not just won't be admitted to NATO, but will never be admitted to NATO. This demand was refused by the Biden administration, which led to Putin recognizing. Now, this demand was obviously refused by the United States and the Biden administration, which then led to Vladimir Putin, recognizing the separatist-controlled areas of Donbas, those two provinces that had broken away. Putin started to recognize them as independent states, a designation that he then used to justify sending Russian troops in to, quote, keep the peace. So now he's sending his troops into these two Ukrainian provinces that have since broken away from Ukraine. He's considering them independent states so that now he can just send in these peacekeeping troops, quote unquote, to keep the peace between Ukraine and these two provinces that had separated. So it's an utter mess. Everything is unraveling over there, which is a recipe that's just ripe for disaster, and which requires strong leadership on the world stage, which I'm sorry, we did not have during the Biden administration. We did not have strong leadership on the world stage. February 2022, Russia, in the midst of all this chaos, finally launches a full-on invasion of Ukraine through Donbas, a move that was obviously and justifiably criticized across the globe and even from some within Russia, leading to Zelensky declaring martial law and severing all diplomatic relations with Russia. Now, you've heard a lot about Zelensky not having elections since then. Technically, his term ran out at the end of, I believe it was last year. Well, this is why. You can't... When two of your provinces have basically broken away, you have the Crimea Peninsula, which is now under Russian control. How on earth are you supposed to have a meaningful presidential election in the midst of all this, while you are fighting a war on two fronts? It's not reasonable. It's the reason that the declaration of martial law exists. We'll get into some of the comments that President Trump has made. Vladimir Zelensky, in my opinion, is not a dictator. He's not putting off elections because he just wants to remain in power. He's putting off elections, again, this is my opinion, he's putting off elections because his country is in the middle of a devastating and bloody war with its much larger neighbor that's been going on for 3 years. And how are you supposed to get meaningful participation from the parts of your country that are not currently under your control? So that might be a discussion for another day. But so anyway, so all that happens. War rages for the next 6 months, with Russia continually gaining ground, only to then ultimately be pushed back by Ukrainian resistance with a military that was backed by billions of dollars in aid from both the United States and the European Union. That left Russia in a difficult spot, having gained some ground and then lost it. So Russia then began attacking Ukrainian infrastructure, leaving many Ukrainians without basic utilities and basic supplies. Just a horrific circumstance. Now, October 2022, Russia officially annexed four regions of Ukraine, including the two Donbas provinces and two other provinces, leading to increased U.S. sanctions on both Russia and Russian-owned companies. So it's obviously escalating. Now Russia is claiming this territory as its own. This is a real annexation, not the joking one that we've been talking about here. This is real annexation with a real war going on. Now, fast forward to August 2024. Ukraine started, you know, they weren't able to make any progress on the battlefronts in Donbas or Crimea, or in Donbas or Crimea. So Ukraine actually seized control of territory known as Kursk in western Russia in an effort to fight back on a different front. So now Russia owns two parts of what used to be Ukraine, and now Ukraine is controlling territory that technically is part of Russia. So this is not getting any better. In the midst of all this, of course, November 2024, President Trump, who was not shy about where he stood on this conflict, Trump wins the presidential election and vows to end the war upon taking office in January 2025, which brings us basically to where we are now. Now, what is the U.S. role in all this? Now, early on, the support for the Ukrainian effort was almost universal. I mean, we don't support nations invading other nations, okay? Full stop. Support for Ukraine at that time was not political, and it was cheered by most in the U.S. and in Congress. Now, support for this effort began to wane a bit in 2022 and 2023 as this war raged on. The U.S. continues to send billions of dollars in aid, while its own citizens, the American citizens, continue to fight generational inflation and economic uncertainty of their own. And this aid continued despite no one actually defining what our goal in Ukraine was. What were we trying to accomplish? What does victory look like? How do we know when we've achieved it? Even if we do achieve it, how do we ensure that it lasts? And questions like this continued to pile up. What if China gets involved? Well, geez, now North Korea is supporting Russia and has troops involved. What does this mean going forward? Now, the battle lines of this particular war have remained largely unchanged since late 2022. Russia still controls Donbas and Crimea. Ukraine still controls Kursk. People continue to die on both sides of this stalemate with no end in sight. Now, President Biden never made clear what the goal was. He just kept espousing platitudes like, well, as much as it takes for as long as it takes. Well, what is it? What do you mean how long it takes? What is it? What end are we seeking? You know, is the end goal to push Russia all the way out of the territory that it seized? Well, if so, is the world willing to provide the same kind of support that an effort like that would take? Because it would take a force far beyond what has been committed to Ukraine already and would likely and almost inevitably lead to escalation. Well, and cutting funding altogether wouldn't solve the issue either. Just cut bait and say, not our problem. Because undoubtedly that would lead to further Russian aggression, and it would set an extremely dangerous precedent going forward for those around the world with bad intentions to invade neighboring countries if they feel like it advances their interests. So the war inevitably has stalemated. Biden was willing to give Ukraine just enough aid to keep the war going, but never enough to win it. He continued to threaten Putin with sanctions and whatnot, but never enough to force Russia to withdraw its forces. So what now? Where does that leave us? Well, this is the point when it became increasingly political in the United States. Republicans in Congress, as well as Trump, when he was running for president, were growing increasingly weary of sending never-ending aid to Ukraine with no off-ramp in sight, no definition of victory. Now, Democrats continue to say that any decrease or pause in aid would surely lead to, you know, the end of Ukraine and millions of deaths. But again, never offering any viable alternative. And that's become a staple of the modern day left. Just prey on emotions, say, how could you, over and over and over again, but never offer up any meaningful or sustainable alternatives. Well, the United States had enough of that, and Trump wins re-election. One of his campaign promises being to end the war. He campaigned on it. He knows Zelensky. He knows Putin, having dealt with them as president in his first term. Now, with the future funding for this never-ending war now on shakier ground than it has been before, combined with the renewed strength coming from the White House, thank God, both Ukraine and Russia have agreed to meet in an attempt to negotiate a ceasefire and ultimately an end to this war altogether. Which leads to the recent developments specifically of last week. Now, Trump has spoken both to Putin and to Zelensky. He's talked to them on the phone. Now, last week, he held a meeting with Russia, not with Putin, and not even necessarily Trump, but the United States met with Russian authorities in an attempt to figure out a way to end this conflict. This was a meeting at which Ukraine was not present. So, of course, outrage from Zelensky and, by extension, the American left ensued. Now, for those that don't have a level 101 understanding of how negotiating works, there is a name for a negotiating tactic that involves talking to one side without the other side present. It's called shuttle diplomacy. You don't start a negotiation by bringing two opposing parties together in a room, in this case, Zelensky and Putin, right off the bat to just let them start shouting unrealistic demands at each other. What is that going to solve? What are the chances of that meeting having any kind of success? Zero. No, you meet with them separately. You figure out what each side is demanding. You have a talk with them about their demands. What's reasonable? What do you think the other side would be willing to agree to? What's going to be a deal breaker? You do this with both sides, and you do it repeatedly, letting each side know the other's demands and concessions and how the discussion has been going along the way. Then, and only when you feel that there is a reasonable mutual understanding and a mutual desire to consummate an agreement, do you bring the two sides together. Where you've already worked out most of the real difficult details, you've gotten some concessions from both sides, they both know what to expect when they sit down at the table finally together, you work out the last minute final details and you have them sign the agreement. Now, I'm no negotiator, but this seems like real common sense to me. I don't see how putting the two sides together in a room right now with a war that's gone on for 3 years is going to solve anything. It's like putting the leader of Hamas and Benjamin Netanyahu in a room together for 5 minutes and saying, figure it out, guys. Nothing's going to happen there. This has to be brokered little by little where, okay, you guys want this? Well, you're not going to get this. They're never going to agree to that. What about this? And you make suggestions on how both of these sides can give up a little, but get a lot. Not the least of which is stopping the unnecessary death of their citizens. So yeah, this seems completely common sense to me. Which of course means that the legacy media is freaking out about it. As if this is just some completely foreign negotiating strategy never attempted by man. God, this is the only word I can use. It's so childish. And seriously, as if Donald Trump is going to carry these negotiations out through the press. He's dealing with a person that he clearly does not like very much in Zelensky and a dictator that he knows is a complete loose cannon in Putin. Okay, he's not going to negotiate this through the American press. Now, the Democrats and the legacy media are attacking him for some of his recent comments on the conflict. You know, he did go after Zelensky for claiming that he doesn't feel supported by the U.S. despite the billions of dollars in aid that we've sent him for nearly 3 years running now. Trump made some comments that could be construed as him saying that Ukraine was the aggressor, which of course they were not. And they're also saying that he said Ukraine started the war. Now that's not how I interpreted what he said, but I can see how somebody would interpret it that way, especially if they're just looking for a way to criticize him. So here's the thing. You're dealing with a ruthless, malicious dictator like Vladimir Putin. Does it really do you any good to go out in the media and just bash and insult him and piss him off? Is that a good way to get somebody like Putin to come to the table? Ukraine needs this war to end far worse than Russia does. Now, even though we obviously don't agree with Putin, we know he's wrong in everything that he's done, the invasion, the continuance of the war, the escalation of the war, the claims of Ukraine not being a real country, false claims of independence of these Ukrainian separatist provinces. No, you don't have to agree with any of it. But you have to be able to see this conflict from his point of view. As flawed and disagreeable and reprehensible as it is, you have to be able to see it from his point of view. And here is probably the way he's looking at this. The U.S. wouldn't back off the Ukraine-NATO talks. Now, we never forced it through, but we never gave that reassurance. Now, we don't have to do that. But again, you've got to look at this from Putin's perspective. Countries all around Russia have joined NATO, including Finland, Latvia, and Estonia. Now, NATO... yeah, we like NATO, because we're part of it. NATO is Putin's enemy. That's how you have to envision him looking at this. Now put yourself in his shoes. The enemy, NATO, is closing in all around you. What is he supposed to do? What if our, now again, put yourself there. What if our enemies, our biggest geopolitical enemy right now is probably China. What if China was trying to recruit Canada to join their alliance against us? That's what Putin is facing with this Ukraine conflict and NATO being right up on its border. Like I say, Finland, Latvia, Estonia, they're all NATO nations and they all share borders with Russia. Putin didn't want another one. Ukraine, obviously, being the biggest of those. You know, Latvia, Estonia are relatively smaller countries. Putin made it very clear he did not want Ukraine ever to be a part of NATO. And that's why. NATO's his enemy. What if our enemies were trying to recruit Canada to join their alliance against us? What would we do? What would be your opinion of it? So think about that. We can all agree that he's a villainous dictatorial leader. But we have to be able to see things from his point of view in order to reach an agreeable solution. Now, what is that agreeable solution? To me, really, it's the only solution. We and the rest of the peaceful, civilized world cannot allow Russia to run roughshod over a sovereign country that they themselves recognized via a signed agreement. Russia signed it. The Budapest Memorandum. They signed it, recognizing Ukraine as a sovereign country. We're not just going to sit here and allow countries to invade other countries. But we also have to realize what Putin is up against in his own country. Live by the strong hand of dictatorship, die by the strong hand of dictatorship. He knows he can't go back to Moscow and the rest of his gangster regime as the loser of this war. He can't do that because he knows if he does, he's a dead man. He's dead. His family's dead. He knows it. He can't go back as the perceived loser of this war. And we have to recognize that as an irrefutable, if not incredibly regrettable, reality. Putin can't go back to Moscow and his group of gangsters. He was a part of the KGB. He can't go back to that regime as a loser. Because he's a dead man if he does. Ukraine can't last much longer if this continues either. So Ukraine can't last much longer if this war goes on. Putin can't be viewed as the loser if it ends. And in the meantime, people are dying by the thousands in a conflict that has had no end in sight, nor any definition of victory for the side that we're supporting. Again, you want to force Russia off the territory it's claimed? Okay, you can do that. But you better be prepared for World War III, or worse, nuclear war. Because that is the inevitable result of the escalation that would almost certainly ensue. You want to pull all the aid from Ukraine? On the opposite end of the spectrum? Yep, you can do that too. But you better be ready for Russia to continue its aggression and only step it up even further against all the former Soviet republics, if not even beyond that. And you better be ready for China to take Taiwan. For starters, and Iran to continue to provoke chaos in the Middle East, and who knows what happens between North and South Korea. So no, the status quo of just keeping this stalemate going isn't an option. It's not a solution, and neither is either extreme. Neither of those are viable either. That leaves one option, which is a brokered solution through negotiation with a third party, in this case the United States, that is going to give a little to each side and leave everybody walking away from that table feeling a little bit unhappy and a little bit unsatisfied. And a note to all the future warmongers out there, this is the end result of every war in my lifetime. A lot of death, neither side getting everything that it wants, nobody wins. So now how does this particular conflict end? Full credit to Ben Shapiro for this. This is the solution that he has talked about basically since this escalation began, all the way back in 2022. Ben Shapiro sees foreign policy clearer than anyone I've heard comment on the subject. In my opinion, he just gets it better than most other people. So, the war stops. This is the solution that Shapiro has suggested, and I have heard absolutely nothing better than this. I think this would work. better than any other option. The war stops. Russia keeps Crimea and Donbas. We're never going to be able to push them out of there without overwhelming force. And it is very evident that no one is up for that, us or anyone else. Ukraine stays out of NATO, keeps Kursk, the area that it has claimed from Russia, and new border lines are drawn where the current battle lines currently sit. Ukraine is given security assurances through the United States and the European Union so as to deter any further aggression from Russia in the future. Peacekeeping troops from various European nations, members of the European Union, will stay on the ground in Ukraine to accomplish that mission. And Russia understands unequivocally that any further aggression will result in immediate escalation by both the European Union and the West, and any border activity or provocation will be viewed as such. That's where it has to land. No, Ukraine doesn't get back the territory it's lost. No, Russia doesn't get to take over all of Ukraine. No, Russia doesn't get access to any of Ukraine's natural resources, because no, diplomatic relations between those two countries cannot be restored, at least not yet. No, it isn't perfect. A lot of people have died. But the alternatives are unacceptable. And the very nature of negotiations is that no one gets everything they want. Everybody leaves a little pissed off. But it's the best we've got, and really, it's all we've got. President Trump understands this. In my opinion, we're done with Ben Shapiro's opinion, with which I agree here. This is my opinion. In my opinion, Trump is building up Putin through the press to encourage him to make a deal. And Zelensky's going to have to accept it. A potential positive of that is that he may then come off as a more sympathetic figure in his own country, because giving up Crimea and Donbas is not going to be popular with his people. But if he can blame it on the United States or the European Union, he could actually gain support in his own country, even if he comes out of this with less than what would be ideal for him. Putin can go back to Moscow and report that he's claimed Crimea and Donbas as Russia's own, and he can at least show that his efforts were not completely in vain to the gangsters that surround him. I mean, yeah, it's not perfect, but show me anything close to this that the Biden administration ever even talked about, let alone accomplished. Their solution was just kind of keep funding this thing with no end in sight, no defined parameters of victory. That sounds an awful lot like a European version of Afghanistan, and I don't think anyone wants a repeat of that. Few extra tidbits here before we go. There are a few things that I love more than listening to smart people debunk dumbass media claims. Now, regarding all of these aircraft incidents recently, speaking of which, did you see the Delta flight in Canada that flipped over on landing last week? There's live video of it. If you haven't seen it, it's crazy. And the craziest part of it is, thank God, no one died in this crash. Now, go, if you haven't seen it yet, go watch that video and you tell me if you would ever believe that everyone survived if you didn't know it already. Fascinating. And thank God everyone in that accident survived. Now, of course, the media narrative is that Trump's federal cuts have led to all of these. Oh my God. It's so juvenile. It's so middle school in its effort and intellectual depth. Now, the CEO of Delta, whose name is Ed Bastian, wasn't having any of it, and he let the CBS Morning News know it when they tried to lay a trap for him. Here is the Delta CEO chewing up and spitting out the CBS Morning News.
No, the Trump administration recently fired many employees of the FAA administration. Do those cuts worry you, and do you think that impacts the safety? I know you just said it's the safest way to travel, but after looking at all these mishaps, a lot of people are very nervous. Do these cuts affect you?
The cuts do not affect us, Gail. I've been in close communication with the Secretary of Transportation. I understand that the cuts at this time are something that are raising questions. But the reality is there's over 50,000 people that work at the FAA, and the cuts, I understand, were 300 people, and they were in non-critical safety functions. The Trump administration has committed to investing deeply in terms of improving the overall technologies that are used in the air traffic control systems and modernizing the skies. They've committed to hiring additional controllers and investigators and safety investigators. So, no, I'm not concerned with that at all.
Oh, there's nothing more satisfying than a legacy media honk like that getting an answer they're completely not expecting. Good for him. It's so obvious that nothing that the Trump administration has done to this point with the federal budget is immediately affecting air travel. The NTSB and Canadian Aircraft Incident Investigators will determine what happened, not shrieky Democrat politicians and legacy media wonks. I can't even believe some of this stuff is real. Speaking of stuff that I can't believe is real and smart people debunking stupid claims, here's Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary of Shark Tank fame, reminding CNN who the smart people are.
We see you laying off people from the FAA. At this point, nobody at the FAA is dispensable. I think you have to keep everybody there at least, you know, for the time being, because we've had these major plane crashes that you haven't seen in 16 years.
Kevin, the optics of this is what you're referring to.
I think the issue is they're not whacking enough. There's this concept in private equity, when you get a bankrupt company and you go in there, you cut 20% more than your initial read. And then you find, like a pool of mercury, the organization gels back together again. Always cut deeper, harder when there's fat and waste. The FAA, it's not the people. The code is COBOL. It's from the 60s. It needs CapEx put into it for the technology to be upgraded to make it safer. Fat like a chicken. All of these agencies are like big fat chickens dripping over barbecues of fat. This is the best barbecue I've ever seen, but I don't think it's happening fast enough. They're not cutting enough. Keep slashing, keep hacking while you have a 24-month mandate before the midterms. Cut more. More cutting. Believe me, it's going to work out just great. Everybody
should
be happy
about this. Even people with the nuclear codes, cut them too?
Cut everything, because if you don't see what they're doing and they can't show you that they're adding value, you whack.
But it's not clear that they're even asking people to show them, show us what you're doing. Again, this was a story Friday, and literally Elon said, oops, we gotta rehire them because nobody knows how to do what these people know how to do.
Yeah, the nuclear thing. Okay, it gets it wrong once in a while. Big deal. So what?
What about the people with the nuclear codes? Cut them too? Let them go too.
It's like the little pigeons that they are. I love how he didn't even acknowledge it. He didn't even acknowledge that asinine, again, middle school playground level attempt at a counter argument. I love Kevin O'Leary. Just smart as they come and does not have time to suffer idiots like CNN panelists. And last but certainly not least, I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but I am hearing today that, alas, Joy Reid, the biggest racist on television since MSNBC cut ties with Mehdi Hassan, that we have discussed several times on this show, has been relieved of her duties at MSNBC. You know you've crossed a dangerous line when you're officially too racist for MSNBC. I want to hear this triple confirmed before I actually throw a party in her dishonor. But just in case this is true, I wanted to leave you with Joy's parting thoughts.
In America, there's a thing about both white vigilantism and white tears, particularly male white tears. Really white tears in general, because that's what Karens are, right? They Karen out, and then as soon as they get caught, it's like, green waterworks. White men can get away with that too. And it has the same effect. Even as the right tries to politicize the idea that masculinity is being robbed from American men by multiculturalism and wokeism, they still want to be able to have their tears.
Oh, Joy. We're going to miss you. like we miss the flu or COVID or hives. Oh, we're going to miss you, Joy Reid. Say it ain't so. On that note, thank you everybody for joining me once again. This has been Spin Sold Separately. I am JD. Don't be a jerk. It costs nothing to be kind. And I'll talk to you next time.